Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 4. Various Topics. Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 54, October 2002. From the 2002 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmaheiser. Read by Dan Adams. Introductory Note. Unless the text is describing the various names of Muhammad, though various alternative spellings and pronunciations therefrom are used, where it appears in the text, his name will be read as Muhammad throughout. This is my 54th monthly teaching letter and continues my fifth year of publication. In lesson number 49 and number 50, we studied Nebuchadnezzar's dream image, interpreted by Daniel, concerning the four beast empires of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. We saw how the great amount of slave trade caused a mixture of non-assimilable people into the Roman Empire, how the Teutonic German tribes wore down and eventually destroyed Rome, and the destiny of the two-legged image which represented the western and eastern branches of the Roman Empire. In lesson number 53, we discovered the little horn of Daniel 7:8 was the Roman papacy. In this lesson, we will investigate the little horn of Daniel 8:9. To begin, we will read each verse followed by commentary by Adam Clark. I prefer Clark, as his comments are somewhat better than the other commentaries on this passage. Daniel 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. We now come once more to the Hebrew, the Chaldee part of the book being finished. As the Chaldeans had a particular interest in both the history and prophecies, from chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7, the whole is written in Chaldee. But as the prophecies which remain concern times posterior to the Chaldean monarchy, and principally relate to the church, called out assembly, the people of Yahweh specifically, they are written in the Hebrew language, this being the tongue in which God chose to reveal all his counsels given under the Old Testament relative to the New. End quote. Verse 2. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw, that I was at Shushan, in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and was by the river of Ulai. I saw in a vision. Daniel was at this time in Shushan, which appears to have been a strong place where the kings of Persia had their summer residence. It was the capital of the province of Elam, which was most probably added to the Chaldean territories by Nebuchadnezzar. See Jeremiah 49, 34 and 35. Here was Daniel's ordinary residence, and though here at this time he in vision saw himself on the banks of the river Ulai, this is the same as the river Ulaeus, which divided Shushan or Susiana from Elimaeus. End quote. Verse 3. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. A ram which had two horns. In the former vision there were four beasts, pointing out four empires. In this we have but two, as only two empires are concerned here, that is, the Grecian and the Persian. The Babylonish Empire is not mentioned. Its fate was before decided, and it was now at its close. By the ram, the empire of the Medes and Persians was pointed out, as explained by the angel Gabriel, verse 20, and particularly Cyrus, who was the founder of that empire. A ram was the symbol of the Persians, and a ram's head with two horns, one higher than the other, appears as such in different parts of the ruins of Persepolis. This ram had two horns, that is, two kingdoms, that is, Media and Persia, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Media, signified by the shorter horn, was the more ancient of the two kingdoms. Persia, the higher horn, had come up but lately, and was of little historic or political consequence till the time of Cyrus, But in the reign of this prince and his immediate successors, Persia attained a political consequence greatly superior to that possessed at any time by the kingdom of Media. Therefore, it is said to have been higher and to have come up last. End quote. Verse 4. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. I saw a ram pushing westward. The Persians, who are signified by the ram, as well as their founder Cyrus, pushed their conquest west, north, and south. The principal theater of their wars, says Calmet, was against the Scythians northward, against the Greeks westward, and against the Egyptian southward. He did according to his will. There was no other nation at that time that could stay the progress of the Persian arms. End quote. Verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Behold an he-goat. This was Alexander the Great, and a goat was a very proper symbol of the Grecian or Macedonian people. Came from the west, Europe lies westward of Asia, on the face of the whole earth, carrying everything before him, touched not the ground, seemed to fly from conquest to conquest. By the time Alexander was 30 years of age, he had conquered all Asia, and because of the rapidity of his conquests, he is represented as a leopard with four wings in the preceding vision. End quote. Verse 6. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And he came to the ram. This and the following verse give an account of the overthrow of the Persian Empire by Alexander, who ran unto him in the fury of his power. The conflicts between the Greeks and the Persians were excessively severe. Alexander first vanquished the generals of Darius at the river Granicus in Phrygia. He next attacked and totally routed Darius at the Straits of Issus in Cilicia, and afterward at the plains of Arbela in Assyria. End quote. Verse 7. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And brake his two horns. Subdued Persia and Media, sacked and burnt the royal city of Persepolis, the capital of the Persian Empire, and even in its ruins, one of the wonders of the world to the present day. This he did because he was moved with choler against Darius, who had endeavored to draw off his captains with bribes, and had labored to induce some of his friends to assassinate him. Alexander, finding this, would listen to no proposal of peace, and was determined never to rest till he had destroyed Darius and his whole empire. In Media, Darius was seized and made prisoner by some of his own treacherous subjects, and afterwards basely murdered. He cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, totally destroyed the family, and overturned the whole monarchy. End quote. Verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. The he-goat waxed very strong. He had subdued nearly the whole of the then known world. The great horn was broken. Alexander died in the height of his conquests, when he was but about 33 years of age. His natural brother, Philip Arideus, and his two sons, Alexander Agus and Hercules, kept up the show and name of the Macedonian kingdom for a time, but they were all murdered within 15 years, and thus the great horn, the Macedonian kingdom, was broken, Alexander's family being now cut off. And for it came up four notable ones, the regal family being all dead, the governors of provinces usurped the title of kings, and Antigonus, one of them, being slain at the Battle of Ipsus, they were reduced to four, as we have already seen. 1. Seleucus, who had Syria and Babylon, from whom came the Seleucidae, famous in history. 2. Lysimachus, who had Asia Minor. 3. Ptolemy, son of Lagus, who had Egypt. And 4. Cassander, who had Greece and the neighboring countries. These held dominion toward the four winds of heaven. Cassander had the western parts. Lysimachus had the northern region. Ptolemy possessed the southern countries. And Seleucus had the eastern provinces. End quote. Verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great, toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Out of one of them came forth a little horn. Some think that Antiochus Epiphanes is meant. Toward the pleasant land, Judea, so called in Psalm 106:24, Jeremiah 3:19, Daniel 11:16, and 41. End quote. It's with this verse that Adam Clark loses his insight on this passage. To his credit, he does point out that some think that Antiochus Epiphanes is meant. Evidently, he didn't necessarily agree. As to the comment about the pleasant land, we will examine that before we are through. Verse 10, And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host, and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. The host of heaven, the Jewish hierarchy, the stars, the priests, and Levites, the powers or host of heaven are probably intended by our Lord, Matthew 24:29, to signify the whole Jewish hierarchy. End quote. Here again, Adam Clark goes wide of the mark. Rather than being the whole Jewish hierarchy, when it is speaking of the host of heaven, it is speaking of all the lost tribes of Israel. That is the main reason the little horn of Daniel 8:9 cannot possibly be Antiochus Epiphanes. Listen up, people, for you have remained blinded far too long. It's time to wake up and get ready. This vision of Daniel is much greater and doesn't even compare with the incident with Epiphanes and the Maccabees over the desecration of the temple. And now verses 11 through 14. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Unto 2,300 days, though literally it be 2,300 evenings and mornings, yet I think the prophetic day should be understood here, as in other parts of this prophet, and must signify so many years. If we date these years from the vision of the he-goat, Alexander's invading Asia, this was 334 B.C., and 2,300 years from that time will reach to A.D. 1966. End quote. While Adam Clark isn't getting the whole picture, we must give him credit where credit is due. At least in his purview, he understood Daniel's days to mean prophetic years, not literal days. Many clergy and laity alike are still making that same error. When we properly understand the time element, we can see how difficult it is to fit Antiochus Epiphanes into the equation. Yet almost every Bible commentary attempts to do this, and being in the majority doesn't necessarily make it right. especially when the vast majority are blind to the truth of their own identity. The little horn of Daniel 8:9 is Muhammad. The identity author William V. Fowler was aware that Muhammad was the little horn of Daniel 8:9 and said this on page 131 of his book End Time Revelation. In his vision, Daniel saw that the little horn waxed exceedingly great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land, verse 9. Arising south of Palestine, from beginnings in Arabia, the followers of Muhammad, immediately after his death in 632 AD, attacked the Persians in the east before entering Palestine and capturing Jerusalem in 637 AD. Subsequent expansion was rapid, and within 100 years, the Saracens, as they were called, had acquired an empire extending from India to the Atlantic, including all territories south of the Mediterranean and east of Palestine as far as Central Asia. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground and stamped upon them, verse 10. As we have seen, the prince of the host is to be identified with Jesus Christ, so the stars must be the children of Yahweh. This prophecy accurately describes the attitude of the Muslims to the Christian communities that remained within their territories. During the 10-year rule of Omar, the second caliph, from 634 to 644, 4,000 churches were destroyed and the Christians were humiliated. As a sign of the degradation, they were made to wear clothes of less honorable color, and instead of horses, they were made to ride on asses, and while on the streets to give way or bow down before the meanest of people. He magnified himself even to the prince of the host. As we have seen, the prince of the host is Jesus Christ, and this is confirmed by the interpretation which calls him the Prince of Princes, a title that can only be given to Jesus Christ. Although Muslims claim to worship the same God as Christians, the Quran says that they are infidels who say that Christ is God. Jesus is said to be no more than a servant who was favored with the gift of prophecy, while the Muslim creed declared a belief in God and in Muhammad, next after God, as superior to Jesus Christ. The Muslims have clearly magnified themselves against Jesus Christ, the Prince of the Host, thus clearly fulfilling this prophecy. The time of this king's appearance was to be during the Christian era, when the transgressors are come to the full. The prophecy means the transgressions within the Roman Church, which were predicted of the little horn in chapter 7. Since horns in prophecy signify kingdoms rather than individual kings, the king of fierce countenance probably meant Muhammad and his successors, who were called caliphs. Muhammad gave his followers instructions to propagate his religion by the sword. Understanding dark sentences, verse 23, doubtless refers to the mysteries of the Quran. And his power shall be mighty, but not his own power, verse 24. As we saw in the case of Alexander the Great, this expression indicates that his own children would not inherit his power, and in fact, the first caliphs were elected rulers. The last prediction that Daniel makes about the king of fierce countenance is that he shall be broken without hand, verse 25. Although many Arab empires, including the vast Ottoman Empire, have inexplicably collapsed, this prophecy may still have its ultimate fulfillment at the Second Advent, because the sanctuary or temple site at Jerusalem is still defiled by a Muslim mosque known as the Dome of the Rock. Probably the most important prophecy of this chapter is the time period 2300 days, or years, given in verse 14. This prophecy is a future event. It terminates with the climax of the cleansing of the sanctuary, verse 14, with which the end of this present world order begins and gives way to the new order of the ages, the kingdom of Yahweh. End quote. Fowler made a prediction of 1978, but I believe Howard B. Rand has a somewhat better handle on some of the numbers. Rand also identified the little horn of Daniel 8:9 as Muhammad. From Rand's book, Study in Daniel, I will quote segments from pages 200 to 209. Eastern Little Horn. Following all this, Daniel was shown in vision a little horn which arose out of one of the four divisions of the Grecian Empire. There has been considerable confusion among prophetic students concerning the identification of this little horn. Some have pointed to the Acts of Antiochus Epiphanes as being a fulfillment, but though he did profane the temple and persecute the Jews, his army was conquered by Judas Maccabeus in 165 BC, whereupon the sanctuary was cleansed and the worship restored. In trying to make the proper identification of this little horn, it should be carefully noted that Daniel was not informed as to when the little horn would arise. He was only told that it would come up in the territory of one of the four divisions of the Grecian Empire. It could arise before Rome conquered Greece, or it could arise after that conquest, as long as the geographical location of its origin was in the territory of one of the four subdivisions of the Grecian Empire. The vision of the little horn was as follows. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, toward the south and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land, and it waxed great, even to against the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to against the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Daniel 8:9-12. Let's compare translations so that we may have as clear a picture of this vision as possible. Moffat translates this as follows. From one of these emerged a small horn which grew to a great size in the direction of the south, the east, and the fair land of Palestine. It swelled high, as the starry host, indeed it flung some of the stars on high down to the ground and tramped upon them. It even magnified itself to match the prince of the starry host and deprive him of the daily sacrifice, demolishing the place of the sanctuary. Thus was the daily sacrifice profanely treated, the true religion was beaten down, and the horn prospered in its career. Farrar Fenton renders it. And from one of them came out a single horn, which became splendidly great against the south and against the east and against the splendor. Then it exalted itself to fight with the heavens and threw down some of its army and some of the stars and trod on them. It even stood up against the commander of that army and took from him the perpetual offering and threw down his holy dwelling. And an army was given to it against the perpetual for wrongdoing, and it threw down truth to the ground, yet it was active and prospered. All those who have tried to confine the activity of the little horn seen by Daniel in this vision to the few years during which Antiochus Epiphanes was active have completely overlooked the significance of the chronological factors involved and have also failed to note the instructions given Daniel that the events related to the far future. Little horn identified. The little horn seen by Daniel in this vision, therefore, depicted the rise of the power of Mohammedanism, and this identification is further confirmed by the fact that the little horn was to rise out of the territory of one of the four subdivisions of the Grecian Empire. Mohammedanism did arise in the Eastern Empire of Rome prior to the fall of Constantinople and extended its conquest to the south, Egypt, and northern Africa, and toward the east into Arabia and eastward to Persia, and toward the land of Palestine, which came under the full domination of the Ottoman Empire. The fall of Constantinople in 1453 AD brought the Eastern Roman Empire to an end and completed the establishment of the Empire of the Ottomans. Sanctuary demolished. During the 2300 years, from the time the edict was issued, sending Ezra back to Jerusalem, the temple was built and later destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. Muhammad's flight dates from 622 AD, the beginning of the Hajira, or Muhammadan era. In 634 AD, Omar came to power and with an army of fanatics began building his empire. Jerusalem was taken in 637 AD, and the Mosque of Omar was built upon the temple site, thus fully establishing the abomination that maketh desolate, fulfilling the prophecy as rendered in Moffat's translation, deprived him of the daily sacrifice, demolishing the place of his sanctuary. Period of Great Fury. History reveals the extent of the destroying power of this scourge, for the followers of Muhammad did prosper and destroy many people in their ravages and the conquests of Christian peoples. Ottoman had established himself as chief in the north of Asia Minor. He invaded Nicomedia and founded the Ottoman Empire in 1299 AD. By 1353 AD, the Ottomans were established in Europe. The city of Constantinople was besieged and captured in 1453 AD. This ended the Greek Empire when this eastern seat of Imperial Rome was taken by the Ottomans. All Asia Minor had been subjected by the Caliphs, and now the eastern seat of Imperial Rome was infested by Muhammad II on the 6th of March 1453 AD and fell to him on May 29th of that same year. With the fall of the Eastern Empire, which the Saracens could only torment but not destroy, begins a period of great fury and bloodshed as the Ottomans established themselves in Europe and Africa. Daniel saw all this in his vision as he witnessed the power and aggressiveness of the little horn, which, like the little horn seen in the first vision, was also emblematical of an ecclesiastical political power. In the first vision, it was the papacy that rose to power, but now the little horn represented Mohammedanism and the line of the caliphs. Full and unrestrained aggression was assigned to the leaders of the Mohammedan, whose understanding of dark sentences refers to the type of revelation their leaders secured and the inspiration he received. End quote. In order to avoid confusion, I will discontinue quoting Rand any further. If we will take a good look around us, we can see this thing concerning Mohammedanism is not completely dead. It would seem the Almighty is using the Antichrist, quote-unquote, Jews to fight against the Antichrist, Muslims, and the other way around. It would also appear it is time for us to step aside and let them annihilate each other. Here it is fair to point out that following Albert Pike, there are certainly circles within Freemasonry, a known Jew front, who would certainly like very much for this scenario to play out. Conclusion. Daniel chapter 8 is one of the main passages futurists use in their attempt to prove a forthcoming so-called super-duper-pooper colossal Antichrist. With what we have studied so far, it would be very difficult to fit such a personage into Daniel's prophecies, yet they continue to try. I will cite some examples. Commentary on the Whole Bible by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this on Daniel 8, page 751. In the following quote, we will render the words as they appear. He, Antiochus Epiphanes, is the forerunner of the final Antichrist, standing in the same relation to the first advent of Christ that Antichrist does to his second coming. The sins in Israel which gave rise to the Greek Antichrist were that some Jews adopted Hellenic customs, erecting theaters and regarding all religions alike, sacrificing to Jehovah, but at the same time sending money for sacrifices to Hercules. Such shall be the state of the world when ripe for Antichrist. At verse 9 and verse 23, the description passes from the literal Antiochus to features which, though partially attributed to him, hold good in their fuller sense only to his antitype, the New Testament Antichrist. End quote. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says, Volume 1, page 1359, there is no question among expositors that Antiochus is in view in this prophecy. What was prophesied was fulfilled literally through him. However, the prophecy looks beyond Antiochus to a future person, the Antichrist, of whom Antiochus is only a foreshadowing. The coming one is said to stand against the Prince of Princes, verse 25. This can be none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. Thus the prophecy must go beyond Antiochus and look forward to the coming of one whose ministry will parallel that of Antiochus. End quote. The Believer's Bible Commentary by William MacDonald says this on page 1084. The explanation of the vision begins in verse 19 through 22, but at verse 23, we seem to see beyond Antiochus Epiphanes to his future counterpart, a king with fierce features who will ruthlessly persecute the holy people in the tribulation period. End quote. These references are flat out, unequivocally, that means there is no possible compromise over interpretations. Get that? Wrong on both counts. For Daniel 8 speaks neither of Antiochus nor a so-called future Antichrist. While these commentaries err on this passage, sometimes they do extraordinarily well on other passages. To repeat, they err because they are blind to Israel's identity and hence the true identity of the quote-unquote Jew, and they press an agenda with a slant on biblical prophecy that simply cannot be supported by the actual texts of Scripture. It's time for Christians to throw away futurism and accept to seed line. The problem of misapplying the little horn of both Daniel 7:8 and 8:9 to Antiochus Epiphanes originated with the Maccabees themselves. Their disastrous mistake interpreting Daniel was figuring this prophecy in literal days rather than in prophetic year days. Many today are making that same error, including some in Israel identity. Inasmuch as it was 3.5 years from the time that Antiochus profaned the temple until it was cleansed, the Maccabees thought they had their man. Many still go through all kinds of mathematical gymnastics to reconcile both Daniel chapters 7 and 8 in order to make Antiochus fit. Once we come to realize that the little horn of Daniel 7 is the Roman papacy, and the little horn of Daniel 8 is Muhammad, all difficulties disappear. After all, Antiochus Epiphanes was only a small, insignificant pipsqueak in comparison to Muhammad. While Antiochus Epiphanes dealt harshly with a few Jews, Muhammad's Muslim religion grievously affected all of the tribes of Israel, and continues to do so up to this very day. Should one check with some sources, one will find they go to excess to make all kinds of explanations and show all kinds of charts in an effort to prove that Antiochus Epiphanes was the little horn of both Daniel chapter 7 and 8. Do not be misled. They will try to place all the importance on Judah, who they falsely think are quote-unquote Jews, while forgetting the rest of Israel. Don't be deceived by such people, as most of them, like the Judeo-unchristian preachers of today, usually don't know the difference between a quote-unquote Jew and an Israelite. Bringing the subject up to date and in perspective, I shall now attempt to show you the significance of Daniel's prophecy of 1335 days, Daniel 12:12, and what is called in Luke 21:24, the times of the Gentiles, of which both were fulfilled in 1917. But however, I need to explain how I came to that realization. In the mid-1980s, I was learning all about Israel's seven times punishment. I had occasion to attend an identity meeting at Detroit, where Sheldon Emery, E. Raymond Capt, and Paul Johnson, a former Mormon from Red Oak, Iowa, were guest speakers. Paul addressed Matthew 24 in one of his messages. I kept in touch with Paul for about 4 years and purchased many of his videotapes, another of which was on Matthew 24. I still don't agree with everything he presented along that line, but I learned much from him. Near that time, as I was conversing with one of my regular customers at my place of business, he seemed amazed at some of the various subjects I was able to refer to. He, being a Jehovah's Witness, thought I was ripe to become a proselyte. I then received two books through the mail, which he evidently had them send me. Scanning one book, I saw several items which caught my eye, giving me cause to read it. Much of the book was just plain bull crap, but the subject that interested me was the times of the Gentiles. It was beginning to dawn on me that the area of Jerusalem was also under the seven times punishment. Upon mentioning that to Paul, he couldn't comprehend how that area could be subject to that punishment, as the quote-unquote Jews and other people occupying Jerusalem were not true Israelites, which you may concur. Most of us are familiar with how the tribes didn't all go into captivity at the same time, and therefore didn't come out from under the seven times punishment period at the same time. That Jehovah's Witnesses book, Babylon the Great Has Fallen, had some things correct on pages 179 and 180. But in a symbolic or prophetic year, the number of days is fixed at the unchanging number of 360, and each day thereof stands for a whole year, a day for a year, a day for a year. Numbers 14:34, Ezekiel 4:6. In the prophetic book of Revelation, 1,260 days are spoken of as being equal to a time and times and half a time, or 3.5 times, Revelation 12:6 and 14. If we divide 3.5 into 1,260 days, it gives us 360. 360 days to a time. According to a symbolic or prophetic time, would Scripture equal 360 years? Accordingly, a symbolic or prophetic time would scripturally equal 360 years. If now 3.5 symbolic times amounts to 1,260 symbolic days, that is to say, 1,260 years, then twice 3.5, or 7, symbolic times would be twice 1,260 years, that is to say, 2,520 years. Thus, the seven times that are mentioned in Daniel 4:16, 23, 25, and 32, in connection with the tree dream, would stand for 2,520 literal years. In the fulfillment of the greater prophetic meaning, the seven times of 2,520 years began to count when Jehovah God let go the world domination as represented by his typical kingdom on earth. By count then, those Gentile times, those appointed times of the non-Israel nations, would end 2,520 years, about 1914. End quote. They're 3 years off on their arithmetic, but one can see what is meant by the times of the Gentiles. As for 2,520 years, Judea was ruled by foreign powers. Then something interesting happened in 1917, when Jerusalem was delivered to the British. After seven times, it again came under the authority of King George VI, a bona fide descendant of David. King George VI lived until 1952, long enough to decree that the quote-unquote Jews and Palestinians would have to settle their differences by blood. There is no evidence that Queen Elizabeth has ever countermanded that decree. So it is still in effect, and the quote-unquote Jews and Palestinians are still lawfully under the king in Yahweh's sight. Therefore, that unlawful United Nations recognition of Israel in 1948 is null and void. They still have the mark of a vagabond with no legitimate place to call home. Documentation on King George VI's decision concerning Palestine is found in Understanding the Dead Sea Scrolls, edited by Herschel Shanks, chapter by Harry Thomas Frank, page 8. His Majesty's Foreign Office had somewhat irresponsibly decided that, since the problem of Palestine could not be solved by reason, they would withdraw, leaving the two sides to decide the issue by blood. End quote. So that is where we are today. As a second witness to Daniel 12:12 in 1917, an Egyptian coin that year was inscribed 1335 in Arabic. Thus we have two types of people occupying Palestine today: squatters and trespassers. Though I don't agree entirely with the book Testimony in Stone by J. Bernard Necklin, yet his explanation of the times of the Gentiles is supportive of this thesis. On pages 70, 72, 75, 106, 109, and 129. On pages 78 through 80, Nicklin points to the date September 17, 2001 as the beginning of a period of cleansing. That date is far too close to September 11, 2001 to be coincidental. We have already witnessed the exposure of fraud in the money markets and the age-old secret sexual practices of the Roman Catholic clergy. If Nicklin is correct, we are in for some very startling revelations. Scripture says this cleansing will start first with the house of Yahweh. I, for one, am going to enjoy every minute of it. Moreover, many in Israel Identity have the need of being cleansed of the anti-seed line and universalism doctrines. End of Watchman's Teaching, letter number 54. Thank you for listening.